Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Ares.
Good morning, everybody. Today's Wednesday. It's the 30th of August, 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. And I'm so pleased, after a long hiatus because of my own medical condition, we're going to be speaking to Orrin Levin-Waldman, socioeconomic research scholar. And he's going to talk about his most recent article, which is called The Death of Representation, which is like right in your face. And, you know, sometimes I recognize that with Professor Waldman, Orrin Levin-Waldman, that you need to hear his voice in order to be able to recognize exactly where we are. So, first of all, good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Well, one thing that I realize is quite often you're at the head of the curve. It's like I didn't know that I was numb to the reality of what was happening, but the death of representation really puts it all into perspective. And why is it that it's taken the public, and I include myself, why has it taken us so long to recognize the way things transform from what we expected in government and what we have in government? Because, you know, government is functioning on its own without even representing us anymore. So what happened?
I think a large part of what's happening is that the press is kind of distorting the political situation. So what the press does is basically presents everything as an either-or binary, if you will. So,
uh-huh.
You know, if you are for this policy, you're good. If you're against this policy, you must be evil. And this is basically what it has become. If you are a Democrat, you must support whatever any Democrat proposes. And if you're a Republican, you must oppose whatever a Republican president proposes. So, in other words, it's representatives no longer represent their districts as envisaged by the framers of the Constitution. They simply toe the party line, and that's not really the way the system was designed. And quite frankly, for all the talk of democracy out there, we have to protect our democracy, it's really a lot of blowing smoke. The reality is This is not democracy when you simply toe the party line without really seriously representing your constituents.
So how did we move away from what was originally envisaged in the Constitution? Why did we go there? Was that just a construct of the people who were powerful in government that caused other people of their party to align in file? Did they lose out somehow? If not, if they didn't follow instructions from whoever the leader was?
I think it's been an evolutionary process, to say the least. I mean, initially, The framers of the Constitution were somewhat suspicious of democracy. They didn't trust it. They thought that democracy would degenerate into what Aristotle referred to as mobocracy, ruled by the irrational passions of the mob. And we certainly see elements of that in today's politics as well. But so the idea was that you would create a government which really wouldn't govern or would be very difficult to achieve consensus because different people would be representing different constituents. Initially, the states would select the senators. So the states, each senator would be responsive or beholden to their own respective state legislatures. Those were the constituents, not the public in the states, but the legislatures in the states. As that changed with an amendment to the Constitution in the early 1900s, and you had direct election of U.S. senators, now the senators became beholden to the public in their districts and their states as well. The first person to really utilized as an instrument called party government was Thomas Jefferson. He basically thought that the best way to rule or to govern would be on the basis of party loyalty. And he basically could have his sidekick as the Speaker of the House, James Madison in the House, whip up the what they were called Democratic Republicans in those days, whip up members of the same party to voting in accordance to whatever was being proposed from the White House. Or more likely, he would tell Madison what he wanted the House to propose for him to approve. That was kind of the way it worked then. So what we see happening now is, as parties have become stronger, at least as speakers of the House have become stronger in being able to maintain party discipline, members of the House basically toe the party line. If they don't toe the party line, they're fearful they're going to lose key committee assignments, and that would prevent them from seriously representing their constituents. But I think it's actually a bigger concern in the Senate, because the Senate represents a different constituency. Each senator can in effect say, okay, if I'm representing the interests of 51% of my state, and that's in accordance with the party line, then they could say I'm representing my constituents. But you can't say that easily among the House, because the districts are drawn differently.
And then how did we get to this particular position? Was that a power grab by so-called leadership? Is it always that people gravitate towards a higher level, or they stay where they are, and those that gravitated to a higher position of prowess, maybe because of their personality or wealth or some other means? Is that how we eventually get to that point? Does that also happen in a corporate structure as well?
It happens in all structures. I mean, people gravitate towards those who are powerful. People want to be accepted, and people basically associate with those whom they figure will basically serve their best interests. Government is no different than the private sector. And public choice theorists and economics have been modeling this for quite some time. The assumption is each member of Congress has a interest. Their fundamental interest is to be reelected. Not necessarily to serve their constituents, but to be reelected. Serving their constituents is secondary to being reelected. That's why money in politics becomes so critical. If you can raise enough money to be reelected, so be it. Public policy is not necessarily the first priority of members of Congress. It's those who are members of the Senate, however, have more luxury to contemplate matters of the policy and the so-called public good, because they're only running for re-election every 6 years as opposed to every 2 years. So that's the problem that we have built into the system. Madison, nonetheless, thought when he created the system, well, this will be good because it'll be very difficult for the central government to exercise too much power and authority, especially over the states, which he wanted to protect. Therefore, it would be very difficult to achieve consensus, and therefore governments would be very robust and it would move very slowly. The end result would be the protection of individual rights.
So are we getting to the point where there's a disconnect between our elected officials and then there will be nothing that the public can do? Because they're unaware or they just are not as clued into what's happening that's said in their behalf, even though they're not being, as the public is not being respected. So can we really have governance the way it was really thought out by the founding fathers?
I think there is a big disconnect. Take Joe Biden going around the country saying Bidenomics is fabulous. It's working. Yeah. It's doing a wonderful job. Most of the public feels that inflation is a serious issue. Yeah. Truth is, inflation is an issue, but it's not really the key issue. It's a symptom of a larger issue of economic transformations, which nobody has addressed or don't care to address. So, but the point is, you know, Biden and then his people basically say Bidenomics is wonderful. Now, press secretary says, isn't this fabulous? Biden has achieved so much for the economy. Well, not necessarily. I mean, prices are out of control, and people are feel that the Green Energy New Deal is being shoved down their throat.
Yes.
You know, it's very nice to go electric, but if you don't have an infrastructure in place to service electric cars, it's not going to work terribly well. And if the cars are so expensive to begin with that the typical working class individual can't afford one, then you're disconnected in the sense that the elites are really out of touch with ordinary workers who just simply can't afford to be to have the lifestyle of the elites. Now, you know, that's out of touch. But then the press comes along and piles on and says, well, you know, we need to be concerned about climate change. We need to have green energy, blah, and yada, yada, yada. So the end result is, yes, they're very out of touch. So what do the Democrats do? They don't want to ignore the public's concerns, but they want to divert attention from those concerns. Well, let's talk about Trump's indictment, you know, this kind of thing. But that's, you know, and I'm not to downplay them, that there's serious charges, and under no circumstances should he ever be reelected president. But still, you know, you're not addressing the issues that are out there. Nobody's asking the public, well, why do you think prices are on the rise? Do you think that the Federal Reserve Board's attempt to control inflation is serving your interests? Clearly, it's not.
No.
They're not being asked, what kind of job are you in now versus the kind of job you may have been 5-10 years ago? Are you making less, relatively speaking, than you were then? Does a job you're in require more skills training? Were you in manufacturing, and what has the loss of manufacturing meant to you, to your economic situation? Because if you don't address those questions, questions, then you're not going to get a serious answer. So in other words, basically, you know, if you were watching the debate among the Republican contenders, you know, out of the gate, you know, you have DeSantis saying, we have inflation. That's very nice, but you didn't ask the real question.
Yeah, exactly. Where are we going? Are we just muddling through, and it's personalities, and I don't know, their chutzpah, their the temerity of their voice or their language that seems to make them seem as if they're fighting for the public interest, but really they're not. How do we make a judgment call nowadays? Do we need the Ocasio-Cortezes of the world or the Bernie Sanders of the world who are not captivating a large audience, but they're captivating the press, that's for sure, to a great extent. Are we always looking for a challenger without recognizing where we should be? And why don't we carry the middle of the road, which gives a little bit of everyone?
Yeah, I hardly call AOC a great spokesperson for the public interest, but and Bernie Sanders is not exactly either. But it's hard to know what the public interest is, and if the public interest is defined from the perspective of the elites, then you're not going to be in touch with the concerns of ordinary workers. And
exactly.
I think that's
why have
the
we
problem.
Disconnected those? So why have we jettisoned them out of the equation? So it's very elitist, no matter where you look.
Because they don't contribute money to campaigns. They're not organized, and I think that's, you know, I'm tempted to say that the only person in the race that, you know, has been speaking to some extent for the interests of the workers is Robert Kennedy Jr., but I think, you know, the problem is he's such a wacko and conspiracy theorist in a nutshell when it comes to the vaccines and this idea that the CIA killed his father and killed his uncle and you know, so on and so forth. I mean, and they're after the president. Now, the truth is, you have to ask the question, if that were really true, then wouldn't the CIA have taken out more presidents? But still, I mean,
yeah, but also, like, why isn't he lucid enough to recognize that this is not an issue that's going to captivate the nation, and that some people don't even remember those days? I mean, I'm old enough to remember when it happened and when the president was shot, assassinated, but most people don't even remember that far.
No,
so
they
how
don't.
Come he can't get on to the program today?
I don't know. I mean, obviously it's personal for him. And, his father was assassinated by a Palestinian nationalist. I don't know that the Palestinian nationalist was working for the CIA, but I find it hard to believe. But and his war against vaccines, I think, is. I think it is problematic in the minds of many, but still, he talks about elites. He talks about their war on ordinary working class people and the policies they pursue that hurt working class Americans. Now, I think that's useful to some extent, but he's also been called out by some members of the press who suggested he's more privileged than any members of the press have been. So, he's very privileged and certainly comes from a very elite background. So, it's hard to have somebody who's going to speak to those interests of working class Americans. The reality is, to some extent, a very limited extent, Trump did captivate these people. He captured their attention when he talked about trying to bring back manufacturing to the U.S. So in that sense, he was speaking their language. But he didn't deliver on any of this. He didn't really. And when you go attempt to set up a cabinet made up of billionaires and millionaires and members of the economic elite, they're not exactly appealing to working class voters. But
people trusted him to pick the right people to move the agenda forward. But are his constituents even aware of what he's really doing, or are they just captivated by the verbiage, what he says? And what he says isn't always the reality of what he puts into place. And he's very much an elitist.
It's not the reality. He's an elitist of a different sort. He's certainly not the smartest guy in the room. He certainly knows how to market himself, I suppose. And
he's marketing very well.
He's a narcissist. That's for sure. But he's not. He's really has not delivered for his base. Why they continue to support him, I don't know. My gut sense is
I don't get it either.
He's a disruptor, and they want somebody who will disrupt to a certain extent because they feel like the elites, the establishment, continues to ignore their concerns, which I think is by and large true. But
I agree with you. So is there a way to move the equation into a more balanced perspective, or have we gone beyond that? We can no longer go back to something that was better. Well, maybe it wasn't better 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 or 60 or even 100 years ago.
It wasn't better in terms of, the social justice situation. It wasn't better in terms of racial equality. It wasn't better in terms of gender equality. It wasn't better in terms of a lot of things. But in terms of economic growth, or the sense that, there was a middle working middle class, then in some cases it was better. You could graduate from high school and get a working class job without having to go to college or get a graduate school. I think maybe it's long gone, but there is a sense among some we'd like to try to replicate that as much as possible, or at least have government not tell us, as Hillary Clinton did, but we're going to put you out of work when we make these transformations. You know, if your coal industry is growing and more workers are working in mining now than they had in the past few years, and that's a boom in western Pennsylvania, it's a boom in Wisconsin and maybe parts of Michigan, and then you tell them we're going to put you out of work. That doesn't go over too well. Not really a way to work to win over the war with the working class. And then the attitude seems to be, well, you guys are too stupid to understand how this is really for your benefit. That's the approach of any number of members of the economic elite, and the political classes. We just have to educate better.
But what about the unions that are out there? Are they doing the job, or are they also floundering and not knowing what to do and don't even direct their membership to something better? Or pushing them to become a political instrument to push back against the failings of government. So we have no place to go or to look, do we?
There's no easy answer to that. We are, we do have to keep up with the times. We sort of have to be able to retrain for the new economy. But I think there is room to bring back some of the manufacturing bases lost. There is room to maybe have somewhat of a more mercantilist economic policy, which puts the United States' economic interests first over other countries that we're competing with. And I think, when we talk about China and competition from China, I think, I think people have been missing the mark here. I mean, I think if you want to talk about Trump's policy of having trade wars with China, it was probably not the smartest thing in the world. And if you are a conspiracy theorist and you believe the Chinese unleashed this virus on us deliberately, I don't think they did it deliberately, but the question might be, so then what would you expect the response to be to a trade war? That's in that sense, it wasn't the smartest, of course. And the other thing is, the biggest holder of American debt is China. And nobody's really addressed the question of what would happen if, at least in terms of national security, if the Chinese demanded repayment immediately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've never answered questions like that. And why is that? How come we don't have a voice? Well, we have your voice, but is that enough? We don't hear about it from the feds. We don't hear about it from, Wall Street, as if they're unconcerned about it. And China,
invested in China, so you're not going to hear about it from Wall Street. This is true of American industry. Too much is at stake to really address that question in a serious way.
Well, also, in Taiwan, for example, there's this big struggle between China and the United States and Taiwan, protecting them and so on and so forth. But we built the best silicon, I forgot the technology they call it, where they produce these floppy disks or whatever they're called, for technology, which is the best in the world. Why do we put something like that there of all places when it's not secure? Didn't we figure this out 20 years ago? Where are we going wrong? This is what I don't understand. Was it because it was cheaper to build it in Taiwan than it would be to build it in New York or in Pennsylvania or in Arkansas? Why? I don't get it.
Well, it may it may be cheaper to build it in Taiwan, and maybe cheaper to build things in China. And I think that we do look, that's the problem of capital mobility. You know, when labor prices rise in the United States, and they have been rising in the United States, and unions may have a role to play in rising labor costs, then industry will basically try to find places where they can have cheaper labor prices. So the capital moves. Now,
you know, we're killing ourselves, aren't we? I mean,
we are killing ourselves. But
we're importing we're importing Kia products from Korea, which are, I understand, very good products. But the point is, they're cheaper than what we can produce it for. So why don't we put a levy on these sort of things so it doesn't cost less? Or why don't we force our industry to charge a different rate? Or maybe it's time for them to get the hell out. I mean, look, if Elon Musk can do it with his cars, he reduced it, and he's selling more cars than ever. So it can be done.
It is time to do that, but we have to put a priority on American industry and American workers. I mean, the approach has always been, well, workers have to sacrifice for the greater good of higher profits, growth, and whatever. They have to accept lower wage rates. Now, the cost of living is such, they can't accept the lower wage rates. What we have to do is industry has to accept perhaps lower profits.
Or less. Yeah. So is that anathema to the whole concept of our economic, I guess, system?
It is an anathema to our American economic system. It's predicated on the assumption that the purpose of a capitalist marketplace is to make as much money as you possibly can. And so you want to maximize your profit and minimize your costs. It really is that simple.
But we're failing. But we are failing, aren't we?
We are failing
somehow,
in the sense that, you know, we don't have a sense of the public good in all this. In other words, we say the best thing to do is have increase the shareholder price for investors. They should get as much money as they can. If you increase shareholder value by lowering production costs, and that includes reducing your labor rates by shipping your capital overseas, that's a good thing. The shareholder has now received a bigger dividend. That's all that matters. The CEO is getting 500 to 1,000 times what the line worker is making when it used to be 40 times as much. Something's out of whack. When you have wide disparities between the top and the bottom, not in terms of income, but in terms of actual wealth, we have a problem. That's why the middle class is squeezed out. And at some point, the middle class, even the upper middle class, will be squeezed out as well.
Yeah. And so is our political system just unaware of all this? And is the public unaware, so they don't even know how to cast their vote for one person or another? Or is it because the people who stand before us for political office don't even go to these issues? They don't talk about this stuff. It's like, vote for me because I'm the best-looking guy in the room, or the best-looking woman in the room, or you like my clothing, or whatever.
Well, I think the other issue is, look, it's money in politics. And as long as, people in Taiwan and people and the Chinese have lobbyists that can basically lobby for investment China and or Taiwan, basically, that's what's going to happen. They're making large contributions. And I think, whatever's leaking out about, the problems of the Biden family's interest in China and Ukraine or wherever, it's just the tip of the iceberg. It's basically the whole political establishment is receiving contributions to basically for their reelection prospects, that the current president, when he left the office as vice president, gets a big donation to create the Penn Biden Center in Washington, mm-hmm. which is part of the University of Pennsylvania, which is where I now teach, then, you know, we got a problem here. And nobody's addressing that issue. It's not a new issue, to be honest. I mean, we had this issue in the 80s when Saudi Arabia was doing exactly the same thing,
yes.
making large contributions to American universities and the members of Congress and their election campaigns and blah, 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 you know, with
mm-hmm.
the dark money, the lobby on their behalf. It's not new.
Yeah.
Money in politics really is a corruptor, and it's corrupting in ways that people are not really seeing. And, you know, if you're expecting the news media to pick up on this, they
yeah,
have
but there is
too.
Oblivious to what's going on. They don't know what's going on quite often. They just
I think they do. I think they do.
You
they
think
choose
they
not
do?
To cover. They choose not to cover
uh-huh.
because it affects their interests as well. It affects their interests as well.
Well, that's true, too. Like, I know, like, I got sued, you know, even though as far as I was concerned, I said it the way it was, but that doesn't necessarily matter in the court of law. And so it's just fascinating the way everything works. And there is corruption on every level, wherever you look. People stand before us, you know, as they're dressed to the hilt of decency, and they're not. And they're bought and paid for as well. It is absolutely frightening. I didn't know this 30 or 40 years ago, even 20 years ago or 10 years ago. When are we all going to wake up? And even if we do wake up, what do we do about it? We cast one vote. That's it. I don't know how we bring everybody to the auditorium at the same day, you know, to hear exactly what's going on. You present it the way it is, and I wonder what the response is. Do you think that people recognize it, or they just very nice, but then they move on and they don't really incorporate what you've said in your most recent article? But you've been saying this for years.
I think they don't understand. They don't really know enough about the issues. They don't really understand the political system terribly well. They don't understand the economic system terribly well.
No.
You know, it's what some of people like, some people used to call the low information voters. And basically, they are low information. They really don't read. Information comes to you from social media now, they don't even read newspapers anymore, or comes to you from someplace online. It used to be, okay, you watch the television news, but that wasn't terribly informative.
That wasn't informative either,
But, you know, if this is what you get, you're learning everything from social media. And this is invading even elite college classrooms across the country, where people are not reading anymore. They're just getting all their information from social media.
Yeah, exactly. And that's how we get artificial intelligence as well. So we get regurgitation in a different manner as well. It's funny because, you know, everyone said to me, well, are you going to be using it? And I said, no, I'm not going to use it at all. I don't even want to go look there, because my voice will be silenced by this artificial intelligence. So I said, how are you even going to know it's me? You don't. So then there's no credibility there. It's just a machine. So it becomes very problematic. is it just a technology that's going beyond our means, and because we're being less involved in reading and we're not as educated as we think we are, and we're unaware because there's just too much happening all at the same time? Not everyone has your intellect and your knowledge so that you could put one and one and add to two, whereas most people, they see one and one, and they don't even recognize that there's a one and there's another one. They just don't get it. They don't see the equation. You do, which is just astounding, because most people won't get this for another 20 years. I mean, I didn't physically think about it as much until I read your article, because it just pointed it all out. It was like a roadmap, which I knew a little bit here and a little bit there, but I didn't really put it together. I didn't come to a conclusion of where things were going or why they had gotten here. And, you know, I'm not the dumbest guy in the room, but I'm not the most intellectual either. But even so, I guess that's where everybody is to a great extent, except like thinkers like you, who are able to decipher what's in front of their face. How come we're so ignorant of that? Why can't we? Is it because we just don't have the training to look at it, or there's too much on our plate? We don't have enough time to focus?
I think, well, training is part of it, but I don't think if somebody's taking a basic course in American government in their freshman year of college, they're not getting as much of this as they should be. It's a survey course, and it's basically exposed to certain concepts, not going taking in depth look at the subject matter. And we're not, and people don't really read newspapers anymore. So there used to be a time when you taught basic civics in high school, and I'm not sure that's being taught to the extent as much as it used to be. But I think that we also have a political class that runs for office, and they run campaigns on, you know, 2-minute sound bites that grab attention, but they don't really discuss issues. They don't really delve into the issues. But they don't make an attempt to have the public understand why these issues are important. To simply say, oh, climate change is obviously an issue, we have to pay attention to it, as AOC and Bernie Sanders and Michael Bloomberg, basically stress. Oh, yeah, of course it's an issue. Well, okay, explain why. Tell us what the cost was.
Yeah, exactly.
Tell us why. What's involved with the altering our policies to address the issues of climate change, but also address the issues of what happens if we sacrifice our economy as we've known it on the altar of climate change, when other countries are not going to do exactly the same thing. So in other words, if you're going to have fossil fuels, and you're going to be burning these fossil fuels in China and India, then you haven't achieved anything. And to simply say, as John Kerry recently said, well, they'll come around. They'll have to. They have to. Why do they have to? Explain why.
Yeah, they don't have to.
They have to. They have to. Because John Kerry, a member of the elite, said so, obviously. Everybody understands that. He was such a member of the elite, and I remember scenes of him. It was, water skiing off of Nantucket, and he was running for the president of the United States. And it was clear he had no connection to working class Americans whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they were more inclined to vote for the person who at least attempts to play the part, George W. Bush.
Yeah. Absolutely. And we've leveled it down to such a low point. Maybe it is the same low point, except that as times change and we think we're a little bit more intellectual than now than we were in the past, things really haven't changed all that much. And, you know, everything seems to be a soundbite. It sounds good. We're supposedly not supposed to be getting oil from the ground anymore because it's not good for the ecology, and yet we're still doing it, even though they say no, this is not clean energy. We've got to do something else, and so we talk a good game, but we're not following through. Is that the way people really are all the time? Is it because there's a dollar bill connected to everything?
Well, there is a dollar bill connected to most things. I think that when you start getting into these issues and you start actually engaging in the process of altering your programs and your policies, you find out there are problems along the way which you hadn't considered.
Yes.
And then you have to sort of, you know, make alterations in your approach to accommodate the realities which you didn't think existed before.
Mm-hmm. Well, that comes with experience, but we haven't reached a point where things seem to be leveling out, and it's just more mentally lucid, and it makes more sense than it did before. So are we evolving, or are we just playing the same game with a little tweak here and a little tweak there? And it's really all the same thing.
Well, I think tweak here and tweak there is consistent with the notion of incremental policymaking, which Charles Lindblom in the 60s identified as the science of muddling through. Basically, that's also consistent with the nature of the political system that we have in the United States, the consensus model, which is not given to radical change. Never was, never will be.
So is there a system out there at all that you're aware of that is actually functioning on a better level? Is it working better, for example, for the Chinese to have their totalitarian system as opposed to our democratic system? Or would they have in Germany or in France, and so on and so forth? What's functioning?
Well, it's arguably, if you have a totalitarian system or you have a fascist government, you can achieve change in a way that you can't in a typical democratic system.
Right.
And during the Great Depression, there were calls for Roosevelt to be an economic dictator, figuring the only way to get out of the depression would be if he would, in fact, act on his own and basically bypass Congress. Now, I think you see elements of that in the United States where you don't like the way Congress is behaving. You don't like the way you don't think Congress is supporting you, or you don't like the fact that the Constitution gets in your way. This president has basically said, I'll just issue an executive order. So I'll issue an executive order extending, the ban on evictions, even though constitutionally he doesn't have the authority to do that. I'll issue an executive order doing something about student loans, even though he doesn't constitutionally have the authority to do that. And the list goes on and on to basically have it thrown out by the Supreme Court, at a later point. But the point is that, you know, it's difficult to achieve any kind of change in a democratic society.
It is. Is there a way of reining in our corporate structures instead of going across the water to wherever they want to make an investment and to make an investment here? Is there a way of subsidizing that to make it competitive? Or is it an impossibility to be competitive with Taiwan or with, I don't know, with South American country or whatever? It makes no difference where. It's just like, can this be done, or is it already, we're finished?
There are things that you could do, I suppose, but they have their own costs. You could use the tax code to incentivize companies to stay here. But that means they get tax breaks, and that irks socialists, progressives of the world. Basically, it feels unfair that the rich get more tax breaks. But if you do want to keep jobs here, you could sever employment from health insurance by having a government-sponsored program, like a single-payer system like Canada has. So basically, it's not coming out of the profit margins of corporations. Now, that has been the irony is the people who really could benefit the most from this would be corporations, but they've been opposed to it the most because they feel they would lose control of the workers. So, there are things we could do. The question is, are we willing to pay the cost of doing it? And I think the other issue is, you have to say, look, if you at some point, you can use a tax code in such a way, if you really want a drop in your capital gains tax from, what used to be 39% or whatever it was, to 20% or even less, then you have to agree to stay in the country, and you have to invest in the country. But if you're going to move your capital outside the country, then we'll raise the capital gains tax to 50% or 60%. We could do that. These are little things we could do. That flies in the face of
why are we averse?
To be sure.
So why are we averse to something like that? Doesn't that make sense for the American worker and also for the economy?
I think the short of it is most politicians really couldn't care less about the American worker, and members of the elite couldn't care less about the American worker. And if you say, okay, you've got the elite includes well-educated individuals who are earning middle-class incomes, but they're graduates of, Columbia, Harvard, Yale, or whatever, they don't identify with the working class. They identify with the interests of the wealthy or people they went to school with. They really don't understand the working class terribly well. Even if they came from the working class, they're no longer part of the working class. So the working class is not on their radar screen.
That's really frightening to hear you say that, but I recognize that that's the reality. You would think that there would be a populist that would pop up in the political world and say something like this and run for political office, and I would be astounded if someone like that wouldn't get votes, because so many people are working, so they need a job, they need to know that they can feel secure. And why should the jobs go abroad when we could do it here? Why is America subsidizing companies going abroad? Makes no sense, does it? Do we want to be everybody's mommy and daddy around the world? Are we getting anything out of this?
Well, I think that, you need to have somebody who's going to basically say, look, capitalism is a fabulous form of economic organization. It's also the worst form of economic organization, save for all other forms of economic organization. That having been said, we need to find ways for the capitalist marketplace to serve the interests of workers, ordinary workers, and to create jobs to pay well. And we need to rein in mobility of capital to places where labor places are lower. So, if I'm elected, I propose we change tax laws to make it more difficult to move capital and to reward those companies that basically will reinvest in the United States. That, I think, would be a more winning strategy than simply the AOCs and the Bernie Sanders of the world saying, we got to tax the rich. They have to pay their fair share.
Yeah.
They're paying more. They actually are paying their fair share. They're paying more than anybody else. But it doesn't feel that way to a lot of people because they have enough loopholes and deductions that they relatively speaking, they may be paying less. Absolute terms, they're still paying more.
Mm-hmm. And is there a way of putting, some sort of a levy on items that come from abroad so that there is no, they're on the same level playing field? So if we add like another 20 or 30 or 40% tax on an item that's made abroad, would that be a disincentive to corporate America?
It could do that.
To stay here?
You could do that, but we found that that doesn't always work terribly well. I mean, one, first of all, if you used to have high tariffs on Japanese imports, for example, in the 80s.
Yeah.
And we found that most people were still buying Japanese imports because and paying the tariffs because the quality of the car was far superior to
the
quality of anything coming out of the big three. Now, unless you find a way to improve the quality, people can still pay the tariffs. But I think the other problem that we have now is the Japanese became intelligent about this. They said, okay, fine. We'll invest and create plants in the United States. So when people buy those the Hondas and the Toyotas, they are buying cars that were assembled in the United States.
Yes.
So what's your basis for a tariff?
Mm-hmm. Well, that would cause an investment in the United States, wouldn't it? Then? Which it already has.
So it's in that sense that's a good thing. Now the problem with that is that the UAW has not been unhappy with that because these are non-unionized plants. But they obviously don't pay as much as GM plants do, but they do pay a lot more than Walmart pays.
Yeah, exactly. So is there a balance in this, or is this the way we're going to be? Because it doesn't seem to work that well for America. It seems like we're everybody's, rich uncle, and we're helping them defeat us.
Well, again, I think you need somebody to come along and say, explain, look, free markets are great, but they don't always work terribly well. There is something called market failure. And that's why the public sector is necessary. There's a connection between the public sector and the private sector. The two are interrelated. When people talk about we have to decrease public sector investment, but the truth is you would also be hurting private sector investment if you did that. So people have to understand that the marketplace is not it does fail. That's why we have public policies. But they also have to understand that, listening to economists talk about the market of the neoclassical model of competitive markets as though it's dispositive is incorrect. The purpose of economics is to provide information for policymakers to make informed policies. It basically is to explain behavior, nothing more. It's basically a piece of information.
That's very lucid. That makes a lot of sense. Wow. So it doesn't look, though, from a political perspective that we're moving in that direction. So are we just languishing where we are now? We're just like treading water. We haven't drowned yet, but we're getting closer, it seems. It does look like we've been failing for the last 20 years, easily, from the way I see it. It's been all going downhill.
We're not going in the right direction, if that's what you're suggesting.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's
And I don't think it's going to get any better with the particular class of candidates that we have out there.
Problem. Are we asking too much of the people who want to stand for political office because they're unaware of all of this? Maybe it's time for someone like an Orrin M. Levin Waldman to run for political office and to to espouse what you've been saying for many, many years. It's just somehow we're not getting the message. Unless they leave you.
I'm not a candidate. I'm not a salesperson, so I'm not sure I can do anything.
I know
else.
That. Right.
But you know,
you would think that there would be other people who might be inclined to have your base of knowledge, but at the same time, they would love to become involved in politics. It's just like it's like the entranceway to a different reality. Is the public even aware of this enough to even consider someone that could come out of the blue and espouse these sort of concepts? Or is it
I
so anathema to them they just don't get it?
No, the public, if you have somebody who can actually appeal to the public and basically garner their votes,
you
can have somebody out of the blue. That is possible. That's the nature of the system that we have. It's only part of the nominating process that we have. But getting that support is a very difficult proposition, and it takes time. If and when they get elected, they often find that it's a frustrating process that they can't actually get things done. It's very difficult to get things done, the nature of the political system. And again, for all people who talk about, obviously, our democracy this, our democracy that, the system was created to be a democracy. It was created to be a republic. It was intended to protect individual rights. Actually, states' rights before individual rights, but that's the system that we have. But it also wasn't established to basically have party government take over in the name of democracy to basically become, in effect, an anti-democratic force.
Well, but that's what's happened, and why are we unaware of it? I think a lot of people are. It's like we're sleeping at the wheel. We're crashing. We just don't even know it yet. It just doesn't seem to be working.
Because I think if you have people watching The Five or The View or whatever it is they're watching, if you have MSNBC and they're basically saying, no, these Republicans are so opposed to our democracy, and Joe Biden is a great defender of our democracy, not really considering whether he is or not, but, you know, this is your discourse. And the rest of the media piles on, Fox and Newsmax basically are going to oppose everything that Joe Biden does, and MSNBC, CNN are going to love everything he does. It doesn't really matter what he's done or what offenses he's committed.
So there are two sides to the equation, but it's not rational, no matter what side you're on, because it's not balanced. Why have we left that balance? I feel like an anomaly myself quite often, even when I do my reporting. It's impossible. People have an agenda. They come to the equation with an agenda rather than to just take it the way it is. Why is that so difficult? Or have they lost their capacity to see? Are they myopic now and don't even realize it? How do we become so unaware?
I think part of it is that people are caught up in the daily grind of trying to make a living and, you know, raise their families, and they just don't really have time for a lot of these issues, and we couldn't care, especially when they know that the debate really goes nowhere.
That's true.
You know, I think I could see a number of people saying, who really cares about Hunter Biden? Who really cares about Trump's indictments? You know, who cares?
Yeah.
That doesn't affect my station in life. It really has no bearing.
Yeah, that is one of the problems. So there's a schism between our elected officials and our those people that are supposedly the electors of our future future, I don't know, representatives, wherever they may be. Was it like that 100 years ago, or were we different then?
I think there's always been the schism, and I think it maybe it's gotten worse over the years, but I think that that divide has always been there. I think the idealism of the framers was that elected officials would have to appeal to the electorate. I think today the nature of the political system is such that elected officials do their best to manipulate the public as much as they possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
So it accords with what the power party narrative happens to be.
Right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So our system, even though it may have been born out of, I don't know, something that was a little bit more valid in our thinking, is the British system better because it's more responsive, or is it not responsive? Or does it really make a difference?
Well, we got a parliamentary system is, you know, again, party comes first.
Yes.
And it is party government. And if there's any deviations from the party and it comes to voting on a major issue, the government falls. Now, the system may be slightly better in the sense that you have room for smaller parties to be represented in the parliament, which you don't necessarily have in the United States, although Britain's technically mostly a two-party system. But it's also better in the sense that you have controls on spending in politics. And I think public money is available for campaigns in Britain, so you don't have the level of private spending that you have in the United States. I mean, I think, and that makes a world of difference. It corrupts, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Amazing. Well, I wish we could speak for another hour, but I see that our first hour is already up. So, as always, brilliant, and thank you so much for returning to the air. It's all because of my fault, but I'm really thrilled to be able to speak to you and to understand what you're saying, because there is no other voice that I'm aware of that speaks to the reality, which is a wonder today. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Be well. Anyway, so thanks again. And we'll talk about econlabor.com, which is the website that of Orrin M. Levin-Waldman. So you can go to econlabor.com. Even though the website is called Labor Econ by Orrin M. Levin-Waldman, but the website address is econlabor.com, and you'll be able to read all his writings and catch up. They are so in-depth and so brilliantly defined, which makes it just absolutely breathtaking and a wonderful read. I hope people are not turned off because it seems like a very esoteric subject matter, but it is extremely baseline in the sense that it explains and he explains why and how things are the way they are, and one can extrapolate from that exactly where it can go and why it goes where it does go, and so on and so forth. Just brilliant, brilliant work. I don't say that very easily. In fact, he's the only one I've ever said that about, because he is just above and beyond everyone else that I'm aware of that I've ever met or spoken to. Just absolutely brilliant, brilliant work. It's just... I'm in awe, to be honest with you, and it just is what it is. So hopefully you'll go to the website and see what's what. He's also written quite a bit of work, which is how I learned about him initially. Bear with me a moment here because I want to go to, let me see if I can find the website I want to go to here with respect to this. Let me just quickly see if I put this in place. Yeah. some of the work that he's written, he's published quite a large number of books. One is called Restoring the Middle Class Through Wage Policy, which is subtitled as Arguments for a Middle Class. This was Palgrave, P-A-L-G-R-A-V-E. Another is called Understanding Public Policy in the United States, and this is published by Top Hat, T-O-P-H-A-T. And I learned about him for the first time when he wrote the book called The Minimum Wage, a Reference Handbook, which was published by ABC-CLIO, so ABC-CLIO, and exceptional work. And then, of course, I read about wage policy, income distribution, democratic theory, again by Orrin M. Levitt Waldman. It was written in paperback and published by one of the most esoteric publishers in the nation called Routledge, R-O-U-T-L-E-D-G-E. And then, of course, the case of the minimum wage, which is defines competing policy models, and that was published by State University of New York Press. And that's the story there. So again, you can reach out to Professor Orrin M. Levitt Waldman at www.econlabor.com. And when you go to the website, you'll also see the professor's contact phone number, and so you can reach out to him if you'd like. And I guess that's the story there. So let me just move on to a couple of other things that may be worthwhile for you to know. So let's cover some of the, well, I guess before anything else, let me quickly look at what we have here on the Yonkers Tribune website. Bear with me a moment here. One second. I think actually I caught up with you on what was going on, what we published on the Yonkers Tribune website. So there hasn't been much, that I've posted since. There was an article that was posted by Mike Lawler. He's a congressman, and the title of his work is called 34 of My House Colleagues Urging the Biden Administration to Abandon a Potential Plea Deal that Would Result in No Death Penalty for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Other 9/11 Perpetrators. This is mind-boggling, actually. I concur with him on this issue. And what he did was he wrote this, so bear with me a second here. He writes, Dear President Biden, we write to you with serious concerns regarding recent reports that your administration is negotiating pretrial plea agreements with the terrorists responsible for the terrorist attacks on September 11 of 2001, including Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. According to reports, these agreements would remove the possibility of a death penalty. If true, this would be a grave miscarriage of justice, especially for the families of the 2,977 innocent civilians and first responders we lost that fateful day. As we approach the 22nd anniversary of the horrific attacks of that day, the death toll continues to rise. Thousands of families have faced the repercussions of that day, especially the families of those who worked tirelessly on the pile, trying to find survivors and helping other families find closure. In fact, 434 congressional districts currently have someone utilizing the World Trade Center health program due to 9/11 related illnesses. This mass murder of thousands of Americans and the continued suffering felt by so many to this day was orchestrated by Khalid Sheikh Mohammed.
despite being captured over 20 years ago and charged over 15 years ago, families still have not seen justice delivered. It's unconscionable that your administration would enter into plea deal negotiations that would let Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and other 9/11 perpetrators avoid the death penalty rather than pursuing the most severe consequence for their murderous actions. As a nation, we have said that we will never forget September 11th, and we must never cease fighting on behalf of those we've lost. We owe it to the victims and their families to deliver justice, and that should mean the death penalty for these murderers. We urge your administration not to enter into any pretrial agreements which would remove the possibility of the death penalty and to work to conclude this process to see justice meted out on those who have committed these evil acts. Signed sincerely by Michael V. Lawler, Member of Congress, and also Elise M. Stefanik, also a Member of Congress, Mark Molinaro, a Member of Congress, Nicholas A. Langworthy, a Member of Congress, and Nicole, one second, pressed the wrong button here. Bear with me a second here. Nicole Maliotakis, a Member of Congress, Patrick Ryan, a Member of Congress, Andrew R. Garbarino, a Member of Congress, Anthony D. Esposito, a Member of Congress, Claudia Tenney, a Member of Congress, Nick LaLota, a Member of Congress, Monica De La Cruz, a Member of Congress, Brandon Williams, a Member of Congress, Guy Reschenthaler, a Member of Congress, David G. Valadao, a Member of Congress, Brian, one second, I pushed another wrong button again, Brian Fitzpatrick, a Member of Congress, Jeff Van Drew, a Member of Congress, Bill Johnson, a Member of Congress, Mark Alford, Member of Congress, Derek Van Orden, a Member of Congress, Scott Perry, a Member of Congress, and Marionette Miller Meeks, a Member of Congress, and Josh Brashin, then also a Member of Congress. We also have Steve Womack, a Member of Congress, Michael Waltz, a Member of Congress, Rich McCormick, a Member of Congress, Andy Biggs, a Member of Congress, Mario Diaz-Balart, a Member of Congress, Eli Crane, a Member of Congress, Jen Kiggins, a Member of Congress, Russell Fry, a Member of Congress, Lori Chavez de Remer, a Member of Congress, Carlos Jimenez, but I think it may be pronounced Jimenez, so Carlos Jimenez, a Member of Congress, Dan Newhouse, a Member of Congress, Debbie Lesko, a Member of Congress, and Mike Ezell, a Member of Congress. And he writes, I will never forget the moment during my freshman year of high school when I learned the terrorists had attacked the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. We as a country can never forget that terrible day, and it is incumbent on all of us to demand the full measure of justice against those responsible. Do you believe there should be a plea deal for those responsible? Let me know by responding to the survey below. And so one of the questions is, do you believe there should be a plea deal for Khalid Mohammed and other 9/11 perpetrators? So I answered no. Then you can submit the survey to sign up for updates. And he also points out at the end, this is written by Michael V. Lawler, the Member of Congress of the 17th, representing the 17th District in New York. He says, I'm honored to serve as your representative in Congress. If there's anything we can do for you or your family, please don't hesitate to contact my office, which is at 845-201-2060. The number again, 845-201-2060, or reach out through his website at Lawler, L-A-W-L-E-R dot House, H-O-U-S-E dot gov, G-O-V. So lawler.house.gov. And additionally, you can keep up with the latest news on his efforts by following him on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and by opting into periodic updates from his office by clicking onto the website address that he points out. So you could find that on the Yonkers Tribune website. We published it, and it's dated August 29th, which was yesterday, and hope you'll find it of value. Anyway, so that's the story there. And I guess that's it on that front. So let's move on to some other issues. Bear with me a second here. Okay, one moment. Okay, let me just see if I get here. Again, I want to move on to some international news. Bear with me a second here. Okay. All right. Well, this is really very interesting. There's an attempted coup in Gabon, which aims to remove the president known as Ali Bongo from power and end a 50-year dynasty. Teams of leading military figures in Gabon in Africa announced on Wednesday that they had placed President Ali Bongo Ondimba under house arrest in a bid to remove him from power after 14 years. The attempted coup comes days after Bongo was re-elected as president for the third time, a role he inherited from his father, former President Omar Bongo. Ali Bongo's victory in his third election campaign was announced early on Wednesday morning by the Gabonese Election Center amid fears of unrest in the Central African country. Before the results came in, opposition figures were already raising concerns over the transparency and legitimacy of the election, accusations which have plagued Bongo, who's 64 since he first ran for president in 2009. The 2009 vote, from which Bongo emerged as the victorious candidate for the Gabonese Democratic Party, came 2 months after the death of his father, Omar Bongo, who had founded the party. Omar Bongo ruled Gabon for nearly 42 years, and his son had served under him as defense minister. Amid accusations the vote had been rigged, the country's economic capital, Port-au-Gentil, was rocked by deadly protests when Bongo was re-elected 7 years later. Back in 2016, violent protests broke out and angry crowds literally set alight to the country's parliament. Around 20 people were killed in unrest that was eventually quashed by police. Meanwhile, the second-time president, backed by Gabon's courts, rejected reports from European Union observers that there was, quote, a clear anomaly, end quote, in the election results. Quote, since 2016, there has been no progress in public freedoms in Gabon. Opponents can express themselves, but they know that there are limits, end quote. Journalist and specialist in African studies, Antoine Glasser, advised Franz Van Katt, quote, they have known for a long time that they can easily end up in prison, as happened during the last presidential election. Well, there is a family legacy involved. Bongo's presidency has, in many ways, followed his father's template. Omar Bongo took office in 1967, 7 years after Gabon claimed independence from French colonial rule. And during his presidency, Bongo Sr. was a champion of France-Afrique, a system through which France maintained a sphere of influence in sub-Saharan Africa while giving veteran African leaders security guarantees. Amid public pressure and social unrest, Bongo in 1990 introduced a multi-party system in Gabon, yet still won three elections from 1993 to 2005, all of which were contested or followed by violence. During his presidency, Bongo Sr. had the reputation of a kleptocrat, one of the richest men in the world, with a fortune stolen from Gabon's oil wealth. In terms of per capita gross domestic product, Gabon is one of the richest countries in Africa, and oil accounts for 60% of the country's revenue. But a third of the population still lives below the poverty line of $5.50 per day, according to the World Bank. The president allegedly pocketed millions in embezzled funds, according to United States and French investigations. Accusations of corruption have passed from father to son. The Pandora Papers investigation in 2021 found that Ali Bongo has connections to secretive offshore entities in international tax havens. French investigators in 2022 charged four of Bongo's siblings with embezzlement and corruption, and believe both Omar and Ali Bongo knowingly benefited from a fraudulently acquired real estate empire worth at least 85 million euros. Well, there is a distance in France, as President Bongo Jr. has also made his mark, particularly on the international stage. Gabon is now recognized as an environmental leader due to successful efforts to safeguard its rainforest and rebuild wild elephant populations. Ali Bongo's presidency has also been marked by a distancing from France. When he first came to power in 2009, Bongo recalled Gabon's ambassador to Paris after France's prime minister appeared to question the legitimacy of his election. Quote, Ali Bongo has never stopped distancing himself from Paris, end quote, said Glazer. Quote, his favorite capital is London, and he has very good relations with the Americans, with China, and also with Muslim countries, including Morocco, in the post-colonial period. If there is one African country that has truly gone global, it's Gabon. But France continues to have a complicated relationship with its oil-rich former colony. Earlier this year, when French President Emmanuel Macron went on a four-nation African tour, Gabon was his first stop. While Macron declared, quote, our interest is first and foremost democracy, end quote, as well as economic partnerships, his visit was viewed by many Gabonese people as giving a political boost to Bongo in the run-up to the August presidential elections. Well, there is clinging to power. Gabon has now been ruled by the same family for more than 55 out of the 63 years since independence from France in 1960. Many inhabitants have only known life under the Bongo family. Quote, it's a family that knows how to cling to power, said Glazer. Well, Wednesday's coup is the second that Ali Bongo has faced during his presidency. During his second term, Bongo suffered a stroke in 2018 that sidelined him for 10 months while he spent recuperating in Morocco. While he was out of the country, Gabonese security forces foiled an attempted coup in January of 2019, during which a small group of plotters took over the state radio and urged the people of Gabon to, quote, rise up, end quote, against the Bongo family's 50-year rule. The plotters were captured by security forces hours later, and two of the amateur group, who had little military support, were killed. Quote, for all its lack of preparedness, the attempted takeover carried a political message, one that highlights the deep distress of the people of Gabon, end quote, researcher Amadou Ba, a member of the African group at the Institute for European Perspective and Security, IPSE, in Paris, advised France and Katz. Well, the failed coup was followed by a doomed attempt by Bongo's chief of staff, Brice Lacrouche Alianga, to oust the sixth president from power. Lacrouche Alianga was sidelined to a ministry position in which he held no power before being ousted from government altogether and eventually arrested in December of 2019 on accusations of corruption. Well, Bongo emerged from his convalescence physically weakened. In videos, his speech was slurred and the right side of his body appeared partially paralyzed, but his grip on power, although shaken, remained intact. Unbelievable. So bear with me a second here. And this is interesting, coming out of Africa as well. This is from Algeria. Algeria's foreign minister proposes a six-month plan for Niger's transition to democracy. Algeria's foreign minister on Tuesday proposed a six-month transitional plan for neighboring Niger, whose coup leader seeks a far longer timeline back to democracy. Ahmed Attaf gave his suggested framework after a tour last week to three of Niger's neighboring countries in the West African bloc known as ECOWAS, which has threatened to send a military force if Niger's new military regime fails to restore democracy. Attaf reiterated Algeria's rejection of military intervention in Niger and said that Algiers would not allow its airspace to be used to that end. He proposed a half-year transitional phase to allow the neighboring country to restore the constitutional and democratic order. In contrast, Niger's coup leader, General Abdulrahman Tiani, has called for a transitional period that lasts for 3 years at most, Attaf said in a televised press conference, quote, but in our view, the transition he refers to, process can be completed in 6 months so the coup does not become a fait accompli, end quote, he continued. Well, the transitional plan would aim to, quote, formulate political arrangements with the acceptance of all parties in Niger without excluding any party, end quote, within the half-year period, the foreign minister of Africa's largest country had said. Well, the progress would be overseen by a, quote, civilian power led by a consensus figure, end quote, he continued without specifying who that might be. Attaf's tour last week took him to Nigeria, Benin, and Ghana, where he held talks against the backdrop of Algeria's repeated calls to prevent a military intervention in Niger. The West African bloc has threatened to use force as a last resort to reinstate Niger's elected president, Mohamed Bazoum, who was detained by his guards on July 26. Attaf's tour concluded, or rather coincided, with a visit by Foreign Ministry Secretary General Lounes Magraman to Niger, where he met members of the military-appointed government, including the Prime Minister, Ali Mahaman Lamine Zain. Attaf on Tuesday reiterated that a military solution would have, quote, catastrophic consequences, end quote, for Niger. He said neither Magram nor Algiers' envoy in Niamey had met with Bazoum, though he did not indicate whether the ousted leader formed part of his country's vision for Niger's transition. Asked whether Algeria would allow its airspace to be used for military intervention, he said, quote, we reject the military solution, so how can we allow for our airspace to be used for a military operation, end quote. Well, Algeria shares a 1,000-kilometer, that's about 620-mile southern land border with Niger. President Abdelmahid Tebboune previously said a military solution would be, quote, a direct threat, end quote, to his country. He stressed, quote, that there will be no solution without us, meaning Algeria, end quote. We are the first people affected, he said. So that's one of the realities we have to think about. So Africa has become quite a hotbed of late because of this situation. 1 second here as we move forward. All right, 1 second here. Now, 1 second. One moment here, let me see if I can get this up.
Well, here's the latest news from Ukraine. Evidently, the Ukrainians are saying that Russia says that a drone attack has hit six regions. It seems that Russian officials said that drone attacks in Pskov damaged four military temporarily caused the airport to suspend operations. Airstrikes also occurred in Kyiv. And so what you need to know, Ukrainian forces launched drone attacks on multiple Russian regions overnight, damaging military planes and disrupting air traffic, Russian officials said on Wednesday. Drone attacks were reported in Pskov, Bryansk, Kaluga, Orlov, and Ryazan regions, as well as the Russian-occupied Crimean Peninsula, Russian officials had said. In Pskov, near the border with Estonia and Latvia, four Ilyushin 76 military transport planes were damaged. Footage shared on social media showed a large fire and smoke rising above the city of Pskov. Pskov Governor Mikhail Vedernikov said on Telegram that there were no injuries, but announced a suspension of all flights in the airport for damage assessment. Quote, if everything is in order, the airport will resume normal operations on Thursday, he said. Well, Russia's foreign ministry said on Wednesday that a wave of Ukrainian drone attacks on Russian territory overnight, quote, will not go unpunished, end quote. There was no immediate comment from Ukrainian officials, and Kyiv does not claim responsibility for specific drone strikes on Russian oil, Russian soil. So, and some more headlines. It seems that Moscow is dismissing a possibility of international probe into the Prigozhin crash. Moscow has dismissed the possibility of allowing an international investigation into the plane crash that it said killed Wagner mercenary chief Yevgeny Prigozhin. While speaking to reporters on Wednesday, Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov said that the investigation into the crash was strictly Russian and that there could be no question of an international probe. Peskov added that Moscow had taken into account the possibility of the crash being deliberate. Quote, it is obvious that several or that different versions are being considered, including the version, you know what we're talking about, let's say a deliberate atrocity, end quote, said Peskov to reporters. It came nearly 2 months after Prigozhin's short-lived mutiny against the Russian military, making Western governments entertain the possibility that Moscow was behind it. Here's a report from the United Kingdom. Bear with me a second here. It seems that rising convictions for desertion among Russian soldiers suggest low morale among troops, the United Kingdom Defense Ministry said on Wednesday. The latest defense intelligence update on the situation in Ukraine that is based on the 30th of August, I'll find out what's going on there. So it seems on August 25th of 2023, two Russian soldiers were sentenced to serve at least 2 years in a penal colony by a military court for refusing to obey orders to return to the front in Ukraine. On July 18th of 2023, the Media Zone News reported that Russia was convincing close to 100 soldiers a week for refusing to fight. If this trend continues, there will be approximately 5,200 convictions a year for refusing to fight. Well, the high rate of convictions demonstrate the poor state of morale in the Russian army and the reluctance of some elements to fight. Refusal to fight likely reflects the lack of training, motivation, and high stress situations Russian forces face along the entire Ukrainian front line. Although some soldiers have refused to fight and attrition rates remain high, Russian highly likely
mitigates their loss by committing a mass of poorly trained soldiers to the front line. Since Russia's September 2022 partial mobilization, Russia has adapted its approach to warfare by utilizing sheer mass for offensive and defensive operations. So, Union came out and is considering a long-term financial support for Ukraine. It seems that European Union defense ministers are meeting in Toledo, Spain, to discuss a 20 billion euro or $22 billion plan for long-term military aid to Ukraine. The plan aims to streamline support Ukraine against Russian aggression and allocate 5 billion euros for arms and training from 2024 to 2027. The European Union diplomat Josep Borrell, the plan's architect, emphasized the need for ongoing support in reconstruction in Ukraine. Quote, it has to continue after the war, whatever happens. It has to continue for the reconstruction and give security guarantees to Ukraine, Borrell said at the start of the meeting. The country has so far received 5.6 billion euros in aid through a separate budget mechanism, as European laws prohibit using its budgets for military projects. So two people were killed and one was injured in Kyiv following a Russian missile strike that led to falling debris and fires in several buildings at the local military, said the local military administration on Wednesday. Quote, as a result of debris falling in Chernivtsi district of Kyiv, two people died, according to initial reports. Sergei Popko, the head of the Kyiv City military administration, wrote on Telegram. So Kyiv Mayor Vital Klitschko also confirmed the distribution by a Telegram post. Klitschko said the bodies were found in a residential building where several bodies meanwhile, the military administration said that air defenses over Kyiv destroyed more than 20 drones and missiles, making it the most powerful strike on the city since the spring. Wow. Also, Russia said that they've targeted boats carrying Ukrainian forces. Russia said on Wednesday destroyed four Ukrainian military boats carrying up to 50 soldiers in the Black Sea. According to the Russian Defense Ministry, an aircraft destroyed four high-speed military boats carrying about 50 members of the Ukrainian Special Operations Forces. The incident occurred around midnight. It's about 2100 Greenwich Mean Time, following the collapse of the United Nations brokered navigation deal for grain ships. There has been increased military activity in the Black Sea region from both Russian and Ukrainian sides. Meanwhile, Russian defenses also intercepted a drone strike near Sevastopol Bay in Crimea, a base for Russia's Black Sea Fleet, officials had said. Well, this comes as Ukraine has recently increased its targeting of Russian ships in its waters and in the Crimean Peninsula. So that's the story there. Bear with me a moment here. Oh, this is really very interesting. A Ugandan could face the death penalty under anti-gay law. It seems that Ugandan authorities have charged a 20-year-old man with aggravated homosexuality, quote-unquote, which carries a possible death penalty under the East African nation's new anti-gay law. LGBTQ people in Uganda have been feeling even more persecuted since the legislation was enhanced in January, or rather in late May. So that's something to be considerate of and to consider of. One second here. One moment. Yes, there are some Syrian protests. Evidently, it's a new revolution, or at issue is it whether it's an economic issue. For the past 2 weeks, anti-government protests in Syria have been gaining momentum. Some say a new revolution is starting in a country torn apart, while others say it's all about people wanting to feed their families. For the first time in years, the flag of the Syrian revolution has been seen flying in parts of the country still under the control of the authoritarian government. The unexpected sight came during a recent anti-government protest in the southern province of Sueda, where up to 2,000 locals had been demonstrating daily for around a month. Today, the Assad regime is at its worst and weakest, I've lost the page for some crazy reason. All right, so we'll have to move on. Bear with me a second here. I think we've finished for the day. Yeah, I think so. Bear with me one more second. Yeah, I think that's it for us. So tomorrow's Thursday, 31st of the month, and hopefully you'll join us then. All the best, and thank you for being with us. Goodbye.